Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear from Nick Jansen as he reports on the accelerated cleanup of an East Chicago toxic waste site. Sharon Jackson talks about gas prices in Northwest Indiana during the past week. And John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Tom Roach, Communication and Creative Arts Chair at Purdue Northwest, about PNW's growing arts programs. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will accelerate cleanup of an East Chicago, Indiana toxic waste site. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports it's one of 21 sites across the country the agency will prioritize.
The Environmental Protection Agency initially estimated cleanup for the site's residential area would cost $23 million. But a new agency report says the estimate should be closer to $85 million. The agency says it'll clean up the site in the same way, but after it did more sampling, it found contamination is more severe than first believed. Attorney Debbie Chisawar says this has been a problem before.
When this investigation of the Superfund site started, they took some samples and got some very high results, but then didn't say, oh, we should check the next block.
Chisawar represents some residents in a lawsuit against the EPA. They want a larger say in the cleanup process. A federal judge will hear those arguments in January. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. The cleanup for part of an East Chicago, Indiana toxic waste site will cost nearly four times more than originally expected. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports the Environmental Protection Agency will open an opportunity for public comments Monday, December 18th.
The cleanup for part of an East Chicago, Indiana toxic waste site will cost nearly four times more than originally expected. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports the Environmental Protection Agency will open an opportunity for public comments Monday.
The Environmental Protection Agency initially estimated cleanup for the site's residential area would cost $23 million. But a new agency report says the estimate should be closer to $85 million. The agency says it'll clean up the site in the same way, but after it did more sampling, it found contamination is more severe than first believed. Attorney Debbie Chisawar says this has been a problem before.
When this investigation of the Superfund site started, they took some samples and got some very high results, but then didn't say, oh, we should check the next block.
Chisawar represents some residents in a lawsuit against the EPA. They want a larger say in the cleanup process. A federal judge will hear those arguments in January. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
The EPA will take public comments on the cleanup cost difference from December 18th through February 16th of 2018. A public meeting will be held in January.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. The EPA will take public comments on the cleanup cost difference from December 18th to February 16th, 2018. A public meeting will be held in January. The Star Plaza Theater in Merrillville, which hosted its first show in December of 1979, will soon be closing. The Oak Ridge Boys will play the final show on December 17th. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Anguiano has more.
The 3,400-seat theater offered what many call an intimate setting for local and national acts. From the yearly Christmas performances to big names like Willie Nelson and Chris Rock, the Star Plaza aimed to cater to a diverse audience. Hammond resident Nathan Ford says he has a lot of fond memories associated with shows at the theater.
I hate going to concerts where it's just like a little figure up on stage, basically not at all having a connection to the performer. That wasn't the case at Star Plaza. You always had a connection to the performer. So you always had a deeper meaning when you saw a show there.
But Forrest says he understands that buildings grow old and don't last forever. Demolition for both the theater and the Radisson Star Plaza Hotel is expected to be completed by summer 2018, though a start date hasn't been set. White Lodging, the parent company for both properties, plans to build a new hotel in the vacant space that sits near the intersection of I-65 and US 30. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Consumers have seen a bit of a hike in gasoline prices in Northwest Indiana during the last week. But Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for GasBuddy.com, says not to worry. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson has more.
The average prices, though, have started to come back down already. That's the good news. The bad news is we're paying about 3 cents more than we were a week ago. But like I said, we saw a pretty big price hike to about $2.59 a gallon. But the statewide averages started coming back down. That's because wholesale prices still relatively low, though all things considered, still paying more than we did a year ago, when, of course, oil prices were much lower.
DeHaan says the change from last year's prices to this year's are tied into production amounts.
A lot of what we were dealing with a year ago was prices that were relatively low, but they started rising very quickly after Thanksgiving, and that was because OPEC decided to cut oil production. So you compare last year to this year, and now we're feeling the full effects of last year's production cut, and that's why the price of oil now is still near multi-year highs at about $57 a barrel. A year ago, oil prices were in the mid-40s, so that big difference is causing us to have to pay more at the pump this holiday season.
Average retail gasoline prices in Northwest Indiana have risen just over 7 cents per gallon in the past week, averaging $2.42 per gallon Sunday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 314 gas outlets in Northwest Indiana. This compares with the national average that has fallen just under 3 cents per gallon in the last week to $2.45 a gallon, according to gasoline price website GasBuddy.com. Including the change in gas prices in Northwest Indiana during the past week, prices Sunday were just under 22 cents per gallon higher than the same day 1 year ago and are just under 24 cents per gallon lower than a month ago. The national average has decreased slightly more than 11 cents per gallon during the last month and stands just under 24 cents per gallon than this day 1 year ago. According to GasBuddy historical data, gasoline prices on December 11th in Northwest Indiana have ranged widely over the last 5 years, at $2.20 a gallon last year, $1.89 a gallon in 2015, $2.53 in 2014, $3.18 in 2013, and $3.33 in 2012. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. A new report from the National Institute on Drug Abuse finds teens are using many substances at historically low rates. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports Indiana teens are in line with national trends.
The annual study has tracked data on teen drug use for over 40 years. This year marks the lowest rates of illicit drug use, including prescription opioids. But vaping is on the rise, and Indiana Youth Institute President Tammy Silverman says that's in line with their kids count data.
One of our 2016 data points puts vaping products at the second highest use after only alcohol for Indiana high school students. So,
National Institute on Drug Abuse Deputy Director Wilson Compton says parents and communities are just waking up to the vaping trend.
These are now the new routes of administration for marijuana, nicotine, and for other substances by teens.
Marijuana use remains consistent for 12th graders at about 23% nationwide. Indiana data puts it at about 20%. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. As America confronts the opioid crisis, environmental scientists are warning about a related problem. Chemicals from painkillers and other drugs often end up in lakes and rivers, creating what some scientists could say a deadly cocktail for fish and other wildlife.
The war on drugs has moved from households to the outdoors.
What we use in our everyday lives goes down the drain and ends up somewhere. It just does.
That's Emma Rosie, an expert in aquatic ecosystems for the Cary Institute. It's a research group located north of New York City. Her team studies a long trail of chemicals from opioids, antidepressants, and even illicit drugs like cocaine. They get into the ecosystem through human urine and feces, and sometimes unused medications get flushed down toilets and drains. From there, they eventually reach streams, lakes, and rivers.
Anything that people are using in their everyday lives. And so when we think about the opioid crisis, which is has a huge impact on people's lives, there's another side of it, which is that those drugs that people use are ending up in their waste stream and getting out into the environment as well, with unknown ecological consequences.
It's a problem across the Great Lakes region. Researchers have found caffeine in waters in Northwest Ohio and nicotine in Lake Michigan. Pharmaceuticals, personal care products, along with other compounds, have been found in the Calumet River in Illinois and the Fox River in Wisconsin. In the Niagara River, which leads to Niagara Falls, elevated levels of antidepressants were found in fish brains. Alicia Perez Fuente Taha is one of the researchers who worked on the project. She's from the Great Lakes Center at Buffalo State College. She says these chemicals are designed to affect human behavior, and fish could be affected as well.
People ask me, oh, are they happy? It's like, no, I don't think antidepressants make people happy either. I think the people don't care so much about things, and that's exactly what they do to fish.
Perez Fuente Taha says fish could become less aware of the risks around them and therefore expose themselves to dangers. They could also become disinterested in reproducing or eating.
And they're exposed to this cocktail 24/7. So a person can be on or off their medications. The fish are always on.
Now, Rosie's research has a different aim. It shows that compounds from amphetamines and other biologically active drugs could cause aquatic insects to emerge sooner, giving them an extended life cycle. Keeping these compounds out of the environment has become a priority for some communities. In the Buffalo area, for example, there are dozens of drop-off sites for unused drugs. They're taken to a central facility, and there, machines grab large barrels of discarded drugs, which are then burned and used for energy. County Health Commissioner Gail Burstein says this process helps keep Lake Erie and other waterways clean and clear.
This is trying to be as green as possible and to help prevent these drugs getting into our water system or getting into our soil and then leaching out into the water system. And as you know, that water treatment plants, their filtration system cannot rid us of all the pharmaceuticals that are flushed down the drain or flushed down the toilets.
Burstein says these drop-off sites allow anyone to help keep drugs out of the Great Lakes ecosystem. For Great Lakes Today, this is Angelica Morrison.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Cedar Lake Town administrators want to bring tourists to their area, and they are taking steps to help make that happen. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spoke with Town Administrator Jill Murr about the plans.
Administrators are doing this through a few projects that include a cleaning of Cedar Lake and an economic development project in the town's Midway Gardens area. Town Administrator Jill Murr is in charge of the lake cleaning project.
Right now, we currently have the feasibility study going through the Army Corps of Engineers approval process. We are told we should have that back this winter. So my winter, obviously, is the actual season of December, January, February, March. In that time frame, we should start seeing that feasibility report get approved with the Army Corps. As we're doing this, the design agreement is going through the same processes for approval.
Murr says pre-construction engineering and design agreements would follow the feasibility report needing to be approved. She says pre-construction engineering would be completed by late fall or early winter of 2018.
And hopefully have construction, which by construction we mean ecosystem work, so not the traditional construction you see, you know, of a building, but restoration of an ecosystem and potentially in late 2019, early 2020.
The restoration of the ecosystem entails removing sediment that keeps getting resuspended in the lake. Murr says as a result, the lake has so much sediment, it doesn't have enough sunlight coming through the water to support the plant life and the fish habitat that's needed. Murr says the lake bottom will need to be dredged and the plant life and habitat reintroduced. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Documents show that U.S. Steel failed to test a Lake Michigan tributary for a potentially carcinogenic chemical after a spill from one of the company's plants in northwest Indiana. The Chicago Tribune reports the incident was the second time this year that the company's Portage plant dumped chromium into Burns Waterway. Details about the failed testing were in an inspection report posted online Tuesday, December 12th, by the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. The records say plant managers told an inspector in November that they had opted not to test for hexavalent chromium, the most dangerous form of the metal. Portage officials have said they're deciding whether to join a lawsuit against the Pittsburgh-based steelmaker that's planned by the Environmental Law Center. Chicago officials are also drafting a lawsuit. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Tom Roach, Communication and Creative Arts Chair at Purdue Northwest, about PNW's growing arts programs. Here's that conversation.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Tom Roach, who heads the Department of Communications and Creative Arts at Purdue Northwest. I think this is our first visit together, Tom, isn't it?
It is. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm glad to have you. I know that Purdue has always been associated more with sciences and engineering,
yes,
and not the arts. However, Purdue Northwest has been establishing itself as a player in the arts for the last number of years now.
Yeah, since Tom Keehan got here as chancellor about 5 years ago, we've broken out of that mold, and we're now trying to position ourselves as more of a metropolitan university where we're offering a full range of classes and college experiences, including sports and theater and art and music and all of that. So we're trying to be the full service university right now.
I know I'm friends with Judy, who has been for many years responsible for putting that fantastic sculpture on the campus in Westville.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And now she's doing that in Hammond as well.
Yeah, I think Judy was the best part of the merger because she had all of this artwork that was in storage. And it just flooded onto the Hammond campus, and we're a much more beautiful site right now because of that. Yeah,
yeah, that's great. She, I've known her for almost 20 years, I would say, and she's on our Regional Arts Council. It's great to have, and it's great to have somebody from Purdue involved in that way.
Sure.
Trish Hales has long
of course,
been on,
yeah. Trish is in my department.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, one of the things that you have going on is an art gallery, a standalone gallery on Kennedy Avenue.
Yes.
Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. It's called the Chess Gallery, and that's because our college at Purdue Northwest is the College of Humanities and Social Education and Social Sciences, and so, you know, that's our acronym.
Mm-hmm.
Gallery's been there going on 2 years. And we're doing shows of student work, also faculty shows, and we're also taking submissions from people in the community as well. And we're hoping to do a high school student show sometime after January 1st.
Mm-hmm. It's a handsome gallery. It's a handsome space.
It is, isn't it? It's just all glass at the front, and it filters through, and we've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other gallery that's next door has multiple tenants, I believe.
Well,
I can't think of
Yeah, Jocelyn Galagas set up a gallery next door. And then once we moved in and put our gallery in, she turned that space over to someone who's running it started out as a coffee shop. I'm not sure what it is right now, but it's a small little restaurant gathering place, and it's been very popular.
It gives people more to do, though.
Yeah.
In that area. So you yourself, you're a photographer.
Yes. My uncle told me once I was going to be a jack of all trades and master of none. And so I paint and do photography, but you know, I'm not the expert on those things.
Have you been at Purdue Northwest for a long time?
Yeah, I think it's my 31st year.
Oh, well, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you've had a career there.
Yes, I did. Yeah, my PhD's in rhetorical theory. Yeah.
Rhetorical theory sounds like something that scares me.
It's kind of scary. It's Aristotle and stuff. But, you know, they didn't hire me to do the art stuff, but, that was sort of always my hobby and my interest throughout my career. Even when I was getting my degrees, I was taking art classes when I could.
So you're over the theater and other all kinds of performing arts.
Yes, yeah.
Activities.
That's all those classes are taught through our department, and we sponsor most of the events. Mm-hmm. English department is also a little bit involved in theater right now, and they're going to be doing more of that. So we're going to have a lot of theater, actually.
And where is it presented?
Well, on the Westville campus, they're involved with the Michigan City groups, and they do things in Michigan City. I'm not sure what the locations are. I'm not as familiar with that area. Mm-hmm. At the Hammond campus, we're doing our big productions in Alumni Hall, and then we do small productions in the Y. Jean Theater, which is mm-hmm. next to Alumni Hall, and it seats about 75. Mm-hmm.
And you have an art and photography summer class coming up in Paris.
I do, yeah. I get to go on that one.
This is not a Purdue thing, and I don't associate all of this. This is fantastic.
We've got Purdue has tons of study abroad stuff going on in the summers. This is just one of many. One of my art teachers set it up and then decided she didn't want to go. And so I said, well, I'm not going to cancel this. I'll take them. And
nice
I went over with four students the first year. And the second year we had 11. And last year we had 10 again.
And it's,
we go to the Louvre three times and, you know, D'Orsay and all the great museums, the Picasso Museum,
yeah.
Orange.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being here, and please come again to tell us what's going on at the Chess Gallery and elsewhere on campus, both campuses, and good luck with everything.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
Gary Mayer, Karen Freeman Wilson came into the Regionally Speaking studio on Monday, December 11th to talk about the impact that Art House, A Social Kitchen in downtown Gary and all of the other projects using funding from the John S. and James L. Knight and Bloomingberg Foundations have on the Steel City. She talks first about the collaborative effect to get Art House started. Here's that conversation.
Art House concept didn't come from Theaster. He certainly jumped in. Mm-hmm. But it came from the fact that Bloomberg was doing a public art challenge. And they were doing it nationwide, and they were willing to give $1 million. And I said, that's good, but we need that public art to do something in service of the community.
Right.
And at the same time, we were talking to the Knight Foundation, and the Legacy Foundation had been so supportive. We were talking to Theaster and his team about how could we do this. And then the University of Chicago was involved, of course, with our own local folk. And so we said, why not have public art that really lives on? It's not just a one-and-done project. It's something that serves the community continuously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the Culinary Incubator came in. And so the Knight Foundation was so excited about the aspect of having a culinary incubator, an opportunity to really drive one of the issues that we thought was a problem in the city, not having enough restaurants. And so this has been just a tremendous project, because we've seen people who may not have had their dreams invested in, who may not have had an opportunity to pursue their ideas. And, you know, there are many people who think, you know, I have a talent in this area. I have a talent in food. I want to be involved. But through the help of the through the Knight Foundation,
right.
we've been able to really allow them to pursue that. And, of course, this is the first anniversary of Art House, and this weekend there will be a public competition, and I'm going to be one of the judges. I'm one of the lucky judges to see if someone who does baked goods, to see who comes out on top, and that person will have an opportunity to provide their goods to Majestic. And we know they have a lot of traffic coming through every day. Mm-hmm. So that's a tremendous opportunity for them.
What a great opportunity to bring not only the people interested in creating businesses, culinary businesses in
sure.
this case in particular, but tying them together with whatever results from the competition, turning into basically an actual contract for services for
it's
the
casino.
It's
sort of like our own Shark Tank of
yeah,
sorts.
It's
and we're excited about that. But we're also very area, and you alluded to it earlier. So Steel City Salvage is a business that doesn't just get involved in the demolition side, but they are involved in the deconstruction side. We know that many of these homes have material that you will never find in a home again. I mean, marble, so much decorative wood, so many unique types of forms of tile. We are getting that, getting those items, and we're able to bring them together and resell them as a benefit to the city. And so as people go through, you know, built-in cabinets, other things that are in these houses that cannot be reused, but we can certainly reuse some of the materials. And that's what's happening. In fact, yesterday I went to an event, and a caterer had used a decorative door from a bookshelf, a built-in bookshelf, to display food. And, you know, folks looked at it and they were like, wait a minute, that's not a plate. That's a door. That's a bookcase door. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful display. And so that's the type of thing that you would find at Steel City Salvage. And that's been a tremendous night project. And then, you know, my own favorite, I have to tell you, and I love Art House. Mm-hmm. I go there whenever possible just to enjoy, because the work that Theaster has done as the artistic director is just phenomenal. The work he's done with wood and with the different areas, the bar and all of that. But my personal favorite in terms of a night project that is being supported is the turning the City United Methodist Church into a ruined garden.
That's going to be very interesting. And this is the way the concept is, has been envisioned by the people working on the project. It's going to be very, very advantageous for anybody to take advantage of when the weather's going to be nice and warm.
It is.
It's going to be a great place to visit.
I can't wait to walk over there. And the concept came out of Europe, because there really aren't that many here in the U.S. But the concept came out of Europe, and it's going to use the main sanctuary still. And, you know, many of us remember going to Seaman Hall as a kid. So Seaman Hall will go away, but the main cathedral portion will still be used for community events. It will be in as much intact as we can maintain it, and it will turn that area, because that's the only sort of blemish, if you will, in that area. So much of the other things have been either demolished or deconstructed or refurbished. You've got a school across the street from there, and we're going to transform that area, the last thing in that area, quite frankly, into something that will be a community asset. We're excited about it.
That's great. I guess now we can look ahead now. I'm sure there'll be more projects that in future years here, and even this next year, when it's time once again to put in something into the city's challenge for the grant from the Knight Foundation.
Well, you
something
know,
else
we've
somebody
been
think of
very,
too.
We've been very fortunate that we, of the last 3 years, of the last 4 years, we've gotten three projects approved. And in fact, Art House was the largest single grant made during that time. Mm-hmm. So we've been very fortunate, and I think we've made great use of it. The Knight Foundation has agreed. The Bloomberg Foundation has agreed. And so we're excited about this Saturday and excited about the next time they offer the challenge.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.com. Where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.